Ultrasound Gel Podcast.
Ultrasound Gel Podcast.
Hello and welcome back to the Ultrasound Gel Podcast. I'm Mike Pratz, and folks, you are in for a treat today. We are starting a special mini-series that will be a discussion of several papers. This was recorded last year when I was honored and privileged to come teach point-of-care ultrasound at a workshop in Dublin, Ireland. And while I was there, I met an incredible group of POCUS educators from around the world. We ended up getting together and recording a podcast of some recent literature that we thought was interesting and relevant. Now, I have to give a big thanks to Andy Neal, who runs the RChem Learning Podcast. That's the Royal College of Emergency Medicine Learning Podcast. He's going to be releasing this on his podcast around the same time, so feel free to check it out there as well. It's going to start off with some introductions of the people that were there, and after that, I'm just going to let the podcast go, and I hope you enjoy it as much as we did.
So, I'm Andy Neal. I'm an emergency medicine trainee in Ireland, and we have...
Hey, I'm Mike Pratz. I'm an emergency physician from Ohio in the U.S.
I'm Rachel Liu. I'm an emergency physician from New Haven, Connecticut at Yale University.
Hi, I'm Catherine Nix. I'm an intensivist and an anaesthetist in Limerick.
Hi, I'm Chris Muir from Stockholm, Sweden. I'm an internist, but still do a lot of emergency ultrasound in the ER.
Hi, I'm Ashley Miller. I'm an intensivist in Shrewsbury in the UK.
Hi, I'm Kian McDermott. I'm based in Dublin in Ireland in the Mater Hospital, and I'm an emergency medicine consultant.
But the paper that I wanted to talk about today is titled Diagnostic Accuracy of Right Ventricular Dysfunction Markers in Normotensive Emergency Department Patients with Acute Pulmonary Embolism. This is the first author was Anthony Weeks, and this was published in Annals of Emergency Medicine in September of 2016. This paper was interesting because it took a look at patients that were already diagnosed with pulmonary embolism, and then they tried to measure the right heart strain in a number of different ways. So they took a look with a focused echo exam to see if they saw signs of right heart strain, and they compared that with serum markers as well as CT findings for right heart strain. And what they found in this, after they performed the study, they had 133 patients, and they ended up excluding some, so they ultimately had 116. And what they found was that goal-directed echo really blew away all the other markers of right heart strain. It ended up having a sensitivity of 100% and a specificity of 99%. So that makes for a positive likelihood ratio of 90, which is really almost unheard of.
And a Solent was like, that's too good to be true,
right.
Surely.
Yeah, and compared to the other markers like BNP or troponin, which a lot of people will use to identify their submassive pulmonary embolisms, those performed much more poorly with, you know, BNP had a likelihood ratio of 2.8, troponin 9.2, and all the CT findings were even performed worse than that. So what I took from this article was that we can perform echoes to diagnose right heart strain, and that's probably the most accurate thing that we have in the emergency department.
Tell me, because I read this paper and found it quite dense and detailed. They had some hardcore echo stuff there. So how did they define right ventricular dysfunction? Because they had a little scoring system.
Yes.
Like, this isn't just somebody eyeballing it and saying, I think this person has RV dysfunction. So this isn't just something maybe you could pick up tomorrow. But
right, that's true. They did try to invent this score at the same time where they're giving point values for certain findings. And they did that both for the ultrasound aspect as well as the biomarker aspect. So when they were looking at right heart strain, what they did was looking for any of three findings: RV enlargement, severe RV systolic function, which was either based on how they visualized the right heart or based on a low TAPC measurement. And then they also looked for intraventricular flattening. So whether that looked like the ventricle is bowing towards the right side or just flat, any of those three things counted as right heart strain. And when they calculated how well it performed, I think it was based off of any of those, not necessarily their scoring system that they right. had.
And the reference standard, like obviously everybody had a PE in the study to start with. So what was their kind of gold standard for right heart strain?
The gold standard was an echo performed by an echocardiographer. And the point they brought up was that we don't always have that accessible. A lot of times when they saw like the time from the diagnosis to getting the comprehensive echo, a lot of times that was over 8 hours or 24 hours later. So that was why they are advocating for emergency physician or provider point of care ultrasound.
Okay, and then and they're using 10 millimeters of TAPSE.
Yeah, they used a TAPSE less than 10 millimeters.
Because that's a bit odd. Usually it's around 16 millimeters, something like that, 17, 18.
Did they say where they got the 10 millimeters from?
I don't recall that. I'm not sure. I know, I don't
which
even
is, think... Which is quite low, huh?
Yeah.
Right, yeah. That's so that's pretty severe systolic dysfunction of the right side. I don't know if they were just wanted to make sure that it was obvious, because they wanted this to be something that I think most people would be able to do. So they erred on the side of making these like visually obvious so that hopefully it's not just a very subtle finding that someone could miss.
Mike, did they talk about the particular views that they used when deciding on the septal flattening?
I think that they probably got an apical four-chamber view and maybe plus or minus some of the other views to look for that, maybe like a parasternal short axis view.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the people doing this, they were fairly well. So five people doing all the ED scans. One was Anthony Weeks, who's a fellowship director. They had two ultrasound fellows and then two residents as well who had extra training before doing this. So again, like a lot of these studies, there's definitely a training curve before you can just walk up and say, oh, you got right ventricular dysfunction. And I found this one of the denser papers in terms of their methods and their techniques for identifying right heart function. And I thought, goodness, I think that's probably beyond me. But
yeah, definitely. You always want to consider that. But I don't see it as a limitation as much as an aspiration.
Yeah, yeah.
So you want people to say, this is the best you can achieve, and you can get there too if you just do some more training. So I think it's good that studies that include people with a lot of training, because it shows us how good the test can be in the right hands.
It's not actually too complicated what they did. If you look at it, they're just showing that the right ventricle was bigger than the left ventricle, yeah, and there was a very severely deranged TAPSE. And that is within the realms of people who do focus scanning rather than being able to do full echocardiography. So this is achievable with not too much training.
So the much more ultimate question here is, yes, we can do this. What do you do with the information? So if you say you find someone who has severe right heart dysfunction on their echocardiogram and they have a known PE, this isn't the trial of this, but now our collective wisdom in the room, what do you then do with that? Say you've got a TAPSE less than 10 millimeters.
I guess it would depend on the situation. You know, if you are having a more crashing hypotensive patient and you see this, then you know they're a candidate for ECOS, which is the actual
what's ECOS? Tell us what
that's
ECOS
is. Catheter directed thrombolytics, but using ultrasound also to assist with it. That's mechanical ultrasound, not diagnostic ultrasound.
Is that commonly available, like in both your centers in Yale and in Ohio as
yes.
well? You have both of that? Okay.
Yep.
So it's an ECOS catheter. It's a particular brand of one, isn't
yeah,
it?
And a lot of times it will be done by interventional, but many of our institutions have started developing the PE response teams specifically for identifying kind of some of these candidates who would have likelihood of success.
I just want to point out that in this study also they excluded all the hypotensive patients or those that they thought would probably qualify as massive pulmonary emboli for that reason, I think. They really want to focus on how ultrasound can help you in that submassive category where they're normotensive, and we know there's a broad range of either they're very well or they're on the cliff where they're about to fall off into cardiac arrest. So because submassive includes such a large range of patients, their idea is maybe ultrasound, especially point-of-care ultrasound, can help you identify those that are more sick and maybe candidates for these other therapies.
Because we're now in the post-PETHO era. The PETHO trial suggested submassive PE does not benefit from reperfusion. But I think one of the big criticisms of that was they were submassive, but they were really submassive. They weren't really that sick. And so there's still lots of people out there look at PE who think there are definitely still the submassive PEs in inverted commas who probably would benefit from reperfusion, and this type of thing could really help. Any other thoughts? What do you do as a group of people who are fairly ultrasound savvy? How do you assess the right heart in PE? What is your own preference? What do you kind of hang your hat on, or what changes your decision makings when you're looking at a patient, PE and otherwise?
All the views that you can get, you know, a lot of times you can try to get your apical for, you know, to see if you have RV enlargement. But, you know, in real life, I think a lot of times the apical four is limited what you get. You can try to do TAPSE, and it would be good to do that, except that a lot of times our apicals are missing that RV free wall, and then it's kind of hard to guesstimate where your TAPSE is. McConnell sign, that is a very good sign. But you can still miss McConnell sign, and you still don't know if it's kind of like they're chronically or they're acutely. And so I think it's kind of a gestalt. What I've started doing is actually started trying to look at a qualitative TAPSE, even if I'm missing a lot of the RV-free wall. If you can get the area where the tricuspid will intersect that wall and you can see how high it's bouncing, and use kind of like the side markers to tell you how high it's going, then it's a way we're exploring to see if there is kind of evidence of right heart strain.
Okay, I'd have a look at the LV. So if the LV is empty, I get worried. If the IVC is plethoric, I get worried. And if the patient is deteriorating. So one of the patients I remember we looked after within the last 3 years was admitted to the high dependency and had a heart rate of 140 that just wouldn't settle and had a known PE. So with the internal physician who was looking after her care and my thoughts on it and increased biomarkers, we then proceeded to full dose thrombolysis in a submassive setting, and she did well. I know that's N equal to one. I think one of the things that looking after these patients has brought home to me is we had another patient who arrived in shock, and we didn't ultrasound them. They were very unwell and needed intubation and then coded, and I still think of that case and wonder if we had ultrasounded them before we intubated them, perhaps we'd have gone with the thrombolysis first. Who knows?
Yeah, we all have these cases in mind. It mightn't be everyone, but I definitely feel echo kind of helps us a lot. Yeah.
With the McConnell sign, I think that's a sort of a lazy man's thing, because you see all the other signs of right heart strain if you have if the McConnell sign is existing, and it's quite high specificity in it, yep. But usually you find all the other strain signs there as well. I often measure tricuspid regurg just to get a pressure estimation and see what's actually
that's
going
on.
The
PA pressure,
yeah,
the modified pressure. Burn ODs, yeah. Carry on. Yeah, yeah.
Because I mean, often I'm happy without. If I don't find it, I don't care about it. I have a look at the right heart all the other ways as well. But if you can actually get a measurement, you get somewhat a number to get into a discussion into thrombolytics. And you can also follow the patient and see what's happening with them. It's also a predictor of what's going to happen with them afterwards as well. The submassive thrombolytic studies, if they have a high pressure, they usually have they are going to get PAH.
Chronic pulmonary hypertension down the line.
Yeah.
When the PA,
which is especially in young patients, it's horrible for them.
Can you or somebody else speak, I heard the 60-60 sign? It's not mentioned in either of these two papers, but I don't think so. But does anybody want to speak to that?
Pulmonary acceleration time. So what you have to get there is you have to get a look at your pulmonary artery. So you go from your peritoneal short axis, and then you fan your probe. So you're looking more at around the mediastinum. And that's that view where your aortic valve's in the middle, the right ventricle and atria kind of wrap around it. And if you get that pulmonary valve there, you can use your pulse wave Doppler and measure the pulmonary acceleration time. So it's not the peak wave, you're measuring the time from the start of the wave to the peak. Yeah. And so the idea is that in more chronic forms of pulmonary hypertension, it takes longer to get to that peak. So if you have less than 60 milliseconds of pulmonary acceleration time to the peak, then that favors an acute process. And the second aspect is what we were talking about earlier when you're estimating the right atrial pressure using the IVC and tricuspid regurgitation, and that also has to be less than 60.
It's kind of
I always do the PA pressure.
Yes, of course.
I feel like it's the first paper and we've reached peak nerd already.
Reached peak
too early already.
But like, you know, the same problems with the apical free wall. I think it's also hard in many patients to get the pulmonic valve. You know, it's not one of our traditional views, even if you go to aortic valve level. So that part, I think, is a little esoteric.
But to be fair, it's not mentioned in this paper, so there you guys are doing something more accessible, so there is levels above. Okay.
But it is a good view to get a TR as well, most people are taught to do it in apical four chamber, but usually in the valve and the short axis valvular plane, it's a good view.
Or tricuspid tilt view.
Sorry?
That's the best view.
Tricuspid tilt view, it's easier.
That's the best view,
But I do like Chris's method of actually looking for TR and measuring the jet, because there are poor man's ways that you can see, especially between acute and chronic RV strain, just without having to calculate the whole pressure. So basically, we're just using velocities and velocity cutoffs to determine if someone has acute or chronic
simple way to distinguish chronic and acute pulmonary hypertension as well is just to measure the RV free wall from the subcostal view. And if it's more than half a centimeter,
So you're talking about wall thickness.
Yeah.
But
also remember that the RV hypertrophies very quickly.
Yeah.
You know, 24, 48 hours.
Yep. And then I'm running to the computer to see if they had RV strain beforehand.
But the 60-60 sign has a place, and that's because it's so hard to differentiate acute from chronic pulmonary hypertension. Sometimes you need to do that type of complicated process to distinguish it, I guess. A lot of times clinically, I feel like, based on the scenario and what we know about the patient's history, we're forced to either assume it's acute or guess maybe this is just the chronic process.
And the trouble you run into sometimes is if you're looking for bowing of the septum, you know, I think that's a big PE that causes that, if it is a PE, and it's a sign that's, if it's there, and if it's there, if it's late, but it kind of pick up that PE where you can intervene.
I've definitely had cases where you have a strict D-shaped septum in a patient who's not hypoxic yet with a good story for PE. And so that would put them in the submassive category, but they're not sick enough to intervene yet. So it kind of goes against using septal bowing as a later sign. I mean, I think it probably could be a little earlier than we initially thought.
I mean, you can definitely have a D-shaped septum and the LV has not been squashed enough yet to compromise cardiac output, and the RV is still functioning well enough, again, to not compromise cardiac output.
Another thing to be cautious about when you're talking about D-shaped septums is to make sure that you're actually getting your correct view. Because a lot of times I see people learning ultrasound, they're a little rotated and they're catching that slice through the ventricle in an oblique plane. That will make sometimes an oval shaped, and occasionally it will look like a D sign that's not actually reflective of right heart strain.
And I remember when I was learning to do your parasternal short axis, to look at that. If you rotate, it looks like a little bishop's hat, or as opposed to a round structure, and that can give you, you know, false positives in that regard as well.
Bishop's hat, nice Irish Catholic country.
You guys have the at least in Sweden, I have a problem with radiologists that they often comment on how the RV looks on the CT scan, and people trust, of course, radiology, they trust the CT scan and often comment on how the RV looks and this and that. And when I go back and check the patient with echo, it doesn't look at all. There's no RV enlargement, or there is RV enlargement. I can see a tricuspid rig erg. So I find my residents and or whatever level of competence that they have, they trust the CT scan more than
it's
the
interesting.
Echo.
It's one of those questions that we don't really have a gold standard. And I think CT automatically is put at a higher level probably than echo. It's considered to be more objective rather than that atmosphere is user dependent, that again quotation marks for about ultrasound. But it's hard that we don't really have a gold standard, do we? I think that's one of the big things about PE. And again, maybe all this discussion circles around the fact that no one single marker, either on CT or ultrasound, is probably sufficient to really truly predict right heart dysfunction. This paper obviously is using a combination of markers of right heart dysfunction, and maybe that's just something we're going to have to learn to live with. There isn't the magic bullet, the single sign we should look for. It should be a combination of things.
To Chris's point, I just wanted to note that in this paper, CT signs of right heart strain were only 79% specific. So radiologists called, looks like there's a dilated RV or there's something that reflects right heart strain, wasn't always right heart strain. That was later seen on the comprehensive echo that was performed.
But that's totally decided by what you decide is the gold standard. In this paper, echo was the gold standard. So if you decide that's the gold standard, it's not surprising that CT is. If you decided the opposite, then it wouldn't be surprising if echo was 79%.
You measured against a different thing.
Yeah, it's complicated.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that. Like I said, this is one of three or four in a mini-series that we'll be releasing over the next few weeks, probably. Please let me know if you enjoy this or if you hate it and would prefer me to never do anything like this again. You can give me some feedback by visiting our website, ultrasoundgel.org, hitting us up on Facebook or Google+, or on Twitter. And also, don't forget to check out our RCEM Learning podcast. You can go to rcemlearning.co.uk for more about them. And as always, looking forward to talking to you later.
More pressure, more gel, more pressure, more gel,
more pressure, more gel, more pressure, more gel.